Welcome to the Earned First podcast. This is Arun Sudharman, founding editor at Earned First. I'm very happy to be joined today by Carolyn Devanayagam, who's the head of Weber Advisory for Asia Pacific and managing director of Singapore at Weber Shandwick. Carolyn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Arun. It's always a pleasure and great to see you. And once again, congratulations on Earned First. It's just such a remarkable feat. And looking forward to our conversation today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show today. And in particular, because you want to talk about, or we want to talk about, a topic that I think is really crucial at the moment. So a few weeks ago, I wrote a newsletter about how geopolitics had become the top priority for corporate affairs leaders. And this was a little bit of a surprise in a way, not if you're looking at the recent history of the communications world. I think we're all aware of how geopolitics has emerged as such an important trend. But if you were to go back, say, 10 to 15 years, for example, and I'm aware you've been at Weber now for two decades, Carolyn, geopolitics hasn't always been such a big driver in terms of the boardroom, in terms of the communications agenda. So how surprising is it for you that it's now the number one priority amongst corporate affairs leaders?
I mean, Arun, to your point, right, I don't think it's a shock just for you. I think it's for all of us. And, you know, honestly speaking, and you know, having done corporate throughout my career, and you said now for almost two decades, it feels like it just came upon us. And obviously, you know, the last couple of years, it has just been the most intense. And, you know, where we basically couldn't differentiate as we were basically counseling and taking clients through the strategic comms initiatives was basically the impact of what geopolitics had on their business and how basically they had to stand up and shore up communications wise. So for me, it is definitely something that, you know, we can't deny it's happening all around us. And it's also why, you know, Weber Advisory has come in to bear the impact of the need to balance the geopolitical, you know, on the outside, and then also to understand where clients want to be from a brand and reputation wise, and then to merge it at that intersection of basically business, and we call it culture. But obviously culture here is all encompassing, and geopolitics plays a huge part of what that means as it shapes up the external environment across all dimensions.
So one of the studies that I cited in that newsletter was from Weber Advisory. Yeah. And it looked at how the America First environment in terms of policies, in terms of rhetoric, is impacting American brands worldwide. And I think it's quite important to look at this because, you know, in this comms world, still largely driven to a significant extent by US-based multinationals. And while US brands are viewed as often as transcending their country's politics, the study from Weber Advisory finds that US policies are undermining brand America on the global stage, particularly thanks to tariff hikes, which are prompting a loss of faith in US trade and investment partnerships. So that's an interesting finding. I don't think it would surprise too many people. But what does that mean for Asian brands? Because there seems to be a lot of interest in terms of how these shifts will impact domestic homegrown players who are perhaps looking to expand beyond their home markets.
Absolutely. Like you said, we look at it in a way as an opportunity. It's not that they are not impacted by the tariffs and what is obviously going on geopolitically and what it means, you know, to basically do business with America. However, as you would have seen, Asian brands are stepping up onto the global stage, and that too with confidence. They have showed up and with leadership that is really a driving force in bringing innovation, cultural relevance, and, you know, truly a new way of thinking to the table. So what we are seeing is an opportunity for these brands in this, you know, in this era where there is some level of pessimism, to truly, you know, own the seat at the table and to also shape, not just participate in the future of global global commerce, and you know, having the opportunity to represent some of the world's largest Asian brands out of APAC as well as globally, we are definitely seeing and feeling that impact, and it's a good place to be in. We feel for those big Asian conglomerates.
Do you feel that they are ready for perhaps the kind of scrutiny that accompanies so-called foreign brands when they expand into international markets? You know, often there's a level of interest perhaps in their supply chains, in their labor practices, in their environmental standards that they may not attract in their home markets. Has that changed at all, do you think, in recent years, their preparation for these kinds of questions that are sometimes a little uncomfortable?
Absolutely. I think, to be fair, Aaron, it happens for some Asian brands more than others, the scrutiny. That said, we have definitely seen a growing respect as well as, you know, confidence as these brands take to the global stage. It is not without any sort of, you know, obviously necessary business concerns that, you know, I would say that any other brands would face. But what we are definitely seeing is there is a change in the tide. We are definitely seeing less of what we would have probably seen even pre-COVID. And with a growing up and a sort of assurance that Asian brands are bringing to the table. And they are basically really offering solutions and innovation, which is very tailored, very culturally resonant, bringing in a lot of that operational might, agility, and in really fast-growing, complex markets. And we do feel that they are also being able to marry, you know, the Asian roots and the way they do business with local practices abroad. And in that, you know, they are basically anchoring a lot of the Asian might in markets by bringing in those capabilities, keeping on to that identity while also, you know, learning to be more, culturally relevant, overseas. And I think that is something that I feel Asian brands definitely have, is the ability to very quickly adapt, understand, learn, and, you know, more than anything, they listen. It is not just about, just going with force and with might. That isn't without consideration. And that is what we are feeling. And I think and seeing, and it is representative of, you know, just how strong some of the major brands are in B2B and in B2C. And like I said, Aaron, there is obviously with any brand, to be fair, but definitely more, so as you pointed out with Asian brands, some level of concern, pessimism, and obviously, you know, depending on where geopolitically some of the relationships lie, there is still obviously those concerns that do arise. But we are definitely seeing that, taper off when it comes to the might and the operational excellence they are bringing to the table.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's important you mentioned how crucial it is for them to listen. And I think that's something that perhaps they understand quite well in terms of their, like you said, like their own cultural underpinnings. Do you see a difference in the way that Asian brands present themselves, the way they go to market, and perhaps how their unique cultures can be used to build trust?
Absolutely. In fact, as we are helping brands and a lot of Asian brands, as I mentioned, grow, it is remarkable to see that, you know, as they look for agility and as they look for scale, they are definitely putting a lot of purpose at the center of it. And I think that is fundamentally an Asian value that, you know, we can't separate from the culture, but it's a beautiful part of about being Asian and about being an Asian brand. And I do think that is a huge differentiator, because definitely, I mean, the cause and the might of doing business and the need to be profitable is very much front and center. But in order for them to do it with impact and to definitely leave a sense of purpose in what they're doing is definitely coming through. There is a want to also carry forward a culture that is unique to Asia. And you're seeing that, right, in some of the strongest parts of the world, of the following of Asian culture now, whether it's K-pop, anime, to design thinking that you're getting from this part of the world. You're seeing that come through more so. But I feel, you know, between, you know, the want to grow and scale and have a presence and own it and be an equal at the table, is also a sense of humility as they learn, they evolve. And like I said, that comes also with listening. They're okay to pause, reflect, understand, and, you know, really take in what the market and the landscape gives versus just, you know, pushing. And I think there is a lot of very good, balancing in the act and the way they do that. And that's a huge differentiator for me, the place that it comes from. And I want to just, you know, recognize that it for me, as I view it, it comes from a place of humility as well.
That's a really important point. One of the common criticisms of American brands, not always, but sometimes, is that they are, you know, overly dictated from head office, and, you know, strategies are made for the world as a whole. It's underpinned a very successful model, but these days you could argue that it's perhaps causing more challenges in different markets, which have different priorities, different expectations, and so forth. And what it often calls for is perhaps, you know, local leaders, local insight, local empowerment, rather than a one-size-fits-all policy. So just reversing that question towards Asian brands, do you think, are they ready to let go in the same way, or do you still see that as a challenge?
I mean, Aaron, I would take it as there is a certain level of benefit having a more centralized way of running in operations. There's definitely efficiency, there's consistency, it's easier to manage, especially in crisis. However, I hear you. Excuse me. What we are definitely seeing is the need to strike a balance. You know, I don't think it's a matter today of centralization versus decentralization. We have to find some level of equilibrium that brings the benefit of both. And some brands are doing it better than others. I've experienced with Asian and with global brands that are basically either headquartered out of Europe or the United States, that have gone through the extremes of being truly centralized, and like I said, bearing the benefits of that, but also the challenges, and then, you know, completely decentralizing, and leaving it all to the market to decide, and also, you know, realizing what that brings to in good and in bad operational, especially when it comes to consistency and efficiency. And so we have definitely, you know, worked with clients to see how we can, you know, manage it, in a more, you know, like I said, with some level of equilibrium. And I think Asian brands, as I see it and feel it and have experienced it, they're beginning to learn how to do that without losing. I think a lot of times it's about losing the essence of the brand and what they stand for. And a part of that would be to ensure that, you know, how you place yourself in any foreign market, still, you know, basically there's a lot of of the culture and the brand that still basically is kept and resonates with local external, let alone internal audiences. And we are seeing a lot of that take place. And we, in fact, are helping a lot of our global Asian brands who are, you know, obviously mighty global brands that have, you know, presence across the world, ensure the cultural piece is managed. And through, you know, especially as they go through change, and, you know, you can't help going through change today in this volatile environment. And sometimes, you know, it's done, whether there are right sizings involved or whether there's a need to expand, etc. But at the core of it, how to keep the culture piece and to make sure that basically is extremely lith and adjustable as brands basically evolve and do business. And like I said, you know, a couple of years ago, most of that work would have been done probably by just US and European headquarters. But now you're seeing Asian brands who have gone abroad, really taking that part seriously to ensure the success of the business.
Mm. It's great to hear. It's probably worth perhaps digressing a little bit here, because not all Asian brands are created equal, first of all, and secondly, Asia is a very big place. So when we're talking about Asian brands, are you perhaps referring to specific markets? I think we're all familiar, of course, with the companies from Japan and from Korea that have you know, made waves globally. But are you seeing emergence of brands from other countries? I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, because, you know, we've heard a lot about Chinese companies going global, for example. But I guess it's quite an interesting environment right now.
Absolutely. And we work with a few, and it's definitely definitely the North Asian brands in Japan and Korea. They've done that too for a very, very long time. And I think with a lot more, I would say calmer and easier, geopolitical, considerations in comparison to obviously China, for example. That said, it's we are seeing a huge amount of Chinese brands who have gone global. We're also working with Indian brands who have made global stage, as well as, you know, brands coming through in Southeast Asia, and even, you know, of course, Australia. So there are a pool of brands, and I would say North Asia tends to dominate the landscape, and that's what, you know, you typically are are familiar with, and you see, especially because of a lot of them also have a very strong B2C presence. But I do not want to dismiss what we are seeing in, especially coming out of India, as well as even in, like I said, Southeast Asia. And you know, it also really depends on the industry around and how they basically have played. Some of them have been across the globe for many, many years, and, you know, with the surge and the passion now for a lot of newer and more evolving brands, that, you know, it's almost like there's a second coming, and some have basically just held global stage. So I think, you know, to summarize, I think there has always been a dominance in North Asia, and that includes China. But I'm definitely experiencing, and we are definitely seeing, the rest of Asia coming to bear, and that too very nicely.
That's great to see. So one of the other considerations in the Weber Advisory Report, just to refer to that again for a moment, is that brands, I think it's specified American brands, should avoid politics, which seems like great advice. But I suspect it's more difficult in practice than in theory. So how do you handle that kind of an equation? Because presumably it's a similar consideration for, I would say, not just American brands right now. I think for all brands at this time, where there's so much heightened complexity and sensitivity it would seem to make sense to maybe be more cautious about political statements or being involved in politics at all. But it's hard, right? Because, you know, even questions about supply chain can raise political considerations. How do you, first of all, is it a realistic goal to just avoid politics altogether in today's day and age?
It is extremely hard, and we experience it across the board, you know, with clients, and it's not limited to just American brands. You know, brands are expected, especially today with the power and the voice of the employee, they expect to have their leadership take a position, the brand they work for take a position. You know, there is a lot around boycotts and the issue of, you know, not participating, pulling out of a certain location due to various, you know, geopolitically charged situation. We saw that happen even during COVID, as well as, you know, obviously the wars over the last couple of years in various locations around the world has also put a lot of pressure on brands to take a position because the employees demand it. And then once it's, and then it's just, then you realize it's not just limited to the employee. People who buy from the brands, whether it's a B2B brand or a B2C brand, today expect a certain sense of responsibility that comes on them basically procuring from the brand and from, and then obviously in the way the brand, you know, handles certain you know, situations in you know, and so like you said, it's really hard to play a independent role from the situation. Absolutely, the position is to not get involved. Obviously, no one is going to condone or support anything that's against you know, human rights, humanitarian situations, etc. And the stance is always to promote goodwill, to do the right thing by all humans kind, as well as to operate in the most ethical and transparent and the best way possible. And so, you know, that's also going back to the purpose, right? And to ensuring the brand basically keeps its integrity throughout. But it's hard. It's hard. We see a lot of brands, you know, struggling with that day in, day out, especially if they have a presence in locations or in, you know, quadrants of, you know, verticals that are of, you know, highly conflicted or, you know, the basically it's a difficult place to be. And I do admire leadership today in terms of just how they've had to step up. And I think it also goes back to, you know, we also put out, you know, a lot around CEOs and their roles and their evolving roles. It has definitely gone beyond, you know, the expectation of just making decisions in the boardroom. There's a huge responsibility being put on them to exercise a great amount of impact outside the boardroom today, and that too to impact you know, at times politically charged situations. So Arun, I don't have a simple yes or no. The counsel that we continuously give clients is obviously doing right and to ensure that the brand's integrity is always managed, as well as, you know, ensuring the people that they serve always, you know, captured for in the right way. But it's a very, very hard place to be in now, given, like you said, you know, geopolitical needs are strife. I mean, you have to have a certain position, and even if you want to keep the most neutral line, and we're not wanting to veer away from that.
Yeah, it does seem like, you know, almost sometimes it seems like a no-win situation. And I definitely don't envy corporates and indeed CEOs having to try and walk that tightrope. But like you said, that they have to balance competing demands, including their employees who more often than not these days are looking for, you know, a certain stance sometimes or reassurance even. Of course, if we look over at America, we see a significant retreat in terms of areas like purpose and ESG, and even diversity and inclusion. And we see companies who are far more reticent about taking on these issues than they were, you know, three or four years ago. There's a significant backlash. Has that impacted companies in this part of the world at all, whether that's multinationals or Asian companies?
Slightly. I wouldn't say it's there was no impact at all, slightly. But at the same time, I would say it hasn't stopped. It continues. The Asian brands are definitely forging ahead. The multinationals are definitely considering and doing what is expected and going, by the countries they operate in, and where possible, doing more. There is obviously, and this is going back to that earlier question, or I should say topic around, the headquarters setting the mandate and needing to follow and how you basically balance that, especially in much more centralized, operational structures. We are definitely seeing some clients who've come to us to basically bring those realities to the table, but also not wanting to stop or basically regress from all the investment and the efforts and just the lives that have been impacted and changed as a result of some of these great initiatives that have been done over the last years. I recall speaking to you, Arun, a couple of years ago just on, where we were in Asia and where we should be. And, we've come a long way, and that was a few years ago. And I think where we are basically seeing, the feedback around, what should we do is at the same time, it's like we don't want to lose momentum and basically regress. So just how do we manage the reality of what is going on over in the US and the expectation around that, and how do we basically keep forging ahead, but obviously putting the right boundaries as well as respect back for the headquarters as they continue to do what's right by this side of the globe.
Yeah, it's another really tricky situation, right? Because
absolutely,
you sort of think we're thousands of miles away. There isn't this right-wing backlash. There seems to be much broader consensus in Asian markets about things like climate change and societal progress and so forth, for now at least, and hopefully for the future too.
Absolutely.
But you can't ignore, you can't ignore the world's biggest economy. You can't ignore where so many of these companies come from. So it's a very difficult balancing act again. So maybe my final question then is, you're looking for skills and you're looking for people all the time in terms of talent, right? That can handle these kinds of questions and that can counsel clients on these issues. And I'm curious to know how easy or difficult is it to find the kind of talent that is able to weigh all of these different considerations, first of all? And if not, what kind of skills should perhaps, younger people be looking to develop if they hope to thrive in this kind of environment?
Oh, that's a question I feel we can spend hours on, and it's also a really, really challenging question in the era of AI, where you feel you actually have a tool who's going to be able to do all of that for you. I have to say, Arun, I don't think you're going to find a solve in a single person, which is why we're also diversifying how we hire. We are not finding a single individual who's going to be able to charge through all of it. We're finding people who've got obviously the experience, and obviously you're aware that that's one of the reasons why we put together group of advisors globally that cut across a diversified range of capabilities that is the council is basically, ranging from strategists that cover media, AI, financial comms, and government, business, because, today it's going to have to be, and we're bringing independent thinking too to the table, aside from what we already have in the organization. And as we look even at our own advisory and as we capture, what we want to do and take forward for clients, it's not just about recasting current roles, but it's really looking about how, you know, our talent is able to basically bolster for this reality out there, aside from doing the day-to-day and a very critical role that they all play in making sure that we are, you know, ultimately still earned first and bringing the power of, you know, true communications to the table. And so as we do that, we also realize clients are just not expecting us to solve at the comms function, but of, like we said, the intersection has now evolved. And so we do need to bring in talent that basically are quite diversified, and it's not basically a one shoe fits all. And so, you know, we are working with a much more robust and diversified pool as such that, you know, do not come from traditional communications backgrounds, but really people who have had experience, whether it's, like I said, in government, you know, in the field, in NGOs, you know, in you know, leading consumer groups, activists, etc., to bring that, to bring a much more holistic thinking. And in terms of the younger generation, you know, I mean, having a great, you know, influx of talent come into the firm all the time, you're seeing a lot of them who are just so savvy with the tools today. And, you know, what basically, you know, I feel every day I'm learning a new tech tool, while for them it's innate. It's, you know, right at the edge of their fingertips. So, where they basically can, I think, can benefit from the fact that they've got that, they're hardwired in tech. They know that, but they can't be over reliant. There needs to still be that pause, the reflect, the listen. Let's not forget the listening, and, you know, using some of those human capabilities that, you know, technology cannot replace, and then bringing in your own critical thinking that is still going to be driven by emotions, by feelings, by personality, because that is the differentiation that, you know, we have against a tech platform. And no matter how advanced a tech platform is to feel, you know, understand, even love, there is a certain element of human behavior that it cannot replicate. And I think that is where the younger generation needs to balance the human instinct, given how you know, hardwired they are in tech. And we do feel that sometimes that is that doesn't come through first and foremost. They are so tech savvy, they're so quick to respond, you know, with a hardwired tech first mode, that and sometimes you're like, no, listen, hold on. You know, learn to understand, learn to feel, learn to experience, put yourself in the person's shoes. Those some basic fundamentals sometimes can be missing. And so I would say the balance, and again, it's all about today, it's all about balance, it's all about equilibrium. You can't over-index in one versus the other. And so, yeah, so that is something that, you know, we keep reminding them, you know, and just to be aware, to read, get deep into the culture, the understanding of the external world, and versus relying, you know, 110% on the tech capabilities that is basically at the end of their, you know, at the edge of their fingertips.
Yeah, culture and humanity, I think, probably increasingly important in a more tech-driven world, and I think that's a great note on which to end. Carolyn, thank you so much for your time and your insight today. Good luck with the balancing act and with finding that equilibrium. But I'm glad to see that, you know, some of these questions are receiving the kind of level of consideration that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Always a pleasure. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the next conversation. Take care.